Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you. Missed you last week, but I took advantage of the opportunity to go to Israel and to visit our brothers and sisters in the South and everywhere else, and they will send you regards.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I heard you led a great solidarity mission. And we'll talk about the aftermath of the war and the ceasefire, obviously, in this conversation, but we have to start with the most recent news of the week, and that is the United Nations yesterday. Ironically enough, and we know that it wasn't irony, you've spoken about the intent and the symbolism of this for weeks and weeks on this program. On the 29th of November, the 65th anniversary of the partition plan, back in 1947, the PA goes, and because of the vote in the United Nations General Assembly of 138-9 with 41 abstentions, the UN General Assembly recognizes the PA as a non-member observer state. Couple of things you're going to have to remind us about, because we know that these types of machinations at the UN have already taken place in the past. There were attempts in the last year or two, as we know. So why did it finally happen now, Malcolm?
Well, last year they tried to go to the General Assembly, to the Security Council, where you need 9 affirmative votes of the 15 members, meaning 9 positive votes, and they could not achieve it. They could not achieve it this year. So they instead went to the General Assembly, and they chose November 29th because it is the anniversary of the partition, in order to add drama to it and saying that, well, Israel got its birthday card on this day and they wanted theirs. And fact is the General Assembly cannot prefer membership status. It cannot prefer statehood on Palestine. Only the Security Council can do that.
Right.
And this is being highly exaggerated in the media in their description of what actually took place. I think also that the chutzpah that they went against the request of the United States and others,
right,
asking them to put it off, that President Obama offered to become a mediator in 2013 if Abbas put it off, knowing that it will change nothing on the ground, not benefit the Palestinian people, not change the relationship, refused to include language that he would return to negotiations as others requested. And I think we should also point out that the vote, while it sounds and was lopsided, it was much less than what was expected. 50 countries abstained or voted against it.
Yeah, you actually,
another half dozen weren't even there.
You actually sent out a press release concentrating on the abstentions, which I thought was pretty interesting. Who was significant on the abstention list?
Well, many of the Europeans, countries like Poland and others who abstained, Germany, amongst those who voted against, and I hope people who have contact or will take the time to call or write the Panamanian government, because they stood against it. Obviously, Canada has been a leader against it. The United States was very strong and outspoken and spoke about this as unproductive and counterproductive and unfortunate.
Why were the Czechs the only European country on the list of those against it?
Because they were the only ones with the courage to stand against the pressures that were brought on them by Arab states, by others.
But you always, you're always in discussion with leaders from different European countries. Have the Czechs always been standouts when it comes to this issue?
Absolutely. The Czech Republic is Israel's best friend in Europe and has been for a number of years. We're worried that elections will bring in new leadership, but this government and Czech Republic has, for a number of years, been the strongest and most staunch advocate for Israel.
The only European country on that side of the vote yesterday.
Right, but we should also note that quite a few abstained, and countries that didn't even show up, like the Ukraine or others, didn't even bother to come to the hall. So I think we should count all of those,
right.
And when you look at who voted for it, there are no surprises. The fact that Russia voted for it is not a surprise, or Syria. So we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a very significant number of countries did not go along with the tidal wave of support, which frankly we're disappointed. Germany, until yesterday morning, was against it and then decided to move to abstention. Italy was abstaining and moved toward support. I think in part, some excused it because they said, well, we need to build up Abbas after you know, Hamas's involvement in Pillar of Cloud or Pillar of Defense, and they became central, and we need to give something to Abbas, and so they're giving him this as if it's some meaningless gesture. It may be meaningless in its essence today,
right.
But the question is, do they exploit it? Do they use it now to go to the International Criminal Court, which said today they're going to review the status after having rejected appeals by the PA to have standing, the Palestinian Authority, to have standing at the court. And, you know, somebody should warn Abbas that it can go both ways. If they accept jurisdiction of the court, war crimes charges can be brought against them as well for all of the terrorism and suicide bombers, things like that.
All right, two important things here. Number one, you just alluded to it, the chutzpah in terms of you know, the slap in the face to the United States, especially when Washington went ahead and tried to, you know, not derail but at least postpone this with some, you know, with some logic and with some strategy, and of course they were completely ignored. So now, if the PA continues to look to the U.S. as a broker of these, you know, peace talks, whatever future there is with peace talks with Israel, is there now going to be a different attitude from this Washington administration? In other words, did the Obama administration take this personally yesterday?
Oh, they certainly did. And if you saw the statements that were made, the anger that Susan Rice displayed, and the activities, you know, they offered so much to the Palestinians in terms of incentives and reasons why they should at least put this off or accept language that would indicate their readiness to resume negotiations without precondition. You know, they could stand to lose a lot. Congress is very angry and is ready to cut the aid. It's not mandated by the law because they're not given member status. Had they been given that, then that would have automatically cut off our dues to the UN and our aid to the PA. But I do think that there will be some consequences, and certainly on the part of Israel, there will be consequences. They don't want to see the PA collapse, neither Israel or the United States, because we have nothing to fill the void except perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood or jihadist groups. So it's a dilemma, but the message has to be clear. And I think the United States and the cooperation at the highest level between the president and Netanyahu, between State Department and the Foreign Ministry and down the line at the UN, was really quite a remarkable, and people talk about it as a turnabout. I think that it's in everyone's interest.
Right.
This is a dangerous precedent. Now, why shouldn't the Kurds do this? Why shouldn't every disputed territory do the same thing?
Correct. Soon the Muslim Brotherhood will look for non-member status in the United Nations. And also, now it sounds absurd, but like you know how history works, you know. We're going to head in that direction. The other thing is that, and you emphasized this 2 weeks ago when we spoke, in terms of Abbas's stature being a challenge because of the way that Hamas essentially was taking control, making the PA irrelevant in the entire process. Hamas did end up being, I know Egypt did, but, you know, and we'll discuss the ceasefire and how it worked and all that. Did yesterday turn Abbas completely around? Because, you know, the publicity and the images that came out of the UN after this vote yesterday, it seems it completely revived him. Would you say it did?
Well, it certainly put him center stage. It certainly, he can declare this a victory because he's been pushing this. This is his legacy. He wants to be able to say that he got the recognition, even though it's not a real recognition. He has never been interested in negotiations. So for him, this does achieve, and it's, I think it's a false sense of legacy or imaginary, but it does put him center, and he can go to the people. The problem is that as that statement we put out said that today Israel continues as a democratic country committed to peace, and the Palestinian people are no better off, and they're going to look at him and say, why were we demonstrating? Why did we celebrate? What did we get for this?
100%. And would you agree that in the aftermath of the war, that because of the fact that Hamas and Israel negotiated through Egypt, that he essentially was left completely irrelevant?
He was left irrelevant during the war, and obviously refused to go to Gaza, has not been in Gaza in all the years since Hamas took over. I think he's afraid to go, and Fatah people there generally are being routed. The fact that Hamas could have demonstrations after the conflict ended, again, illusionary, you know, claiming that they won, and that they, as Henry Kissinger, I think it was, who once said that when a guerrilla wins if he doesn't lose, a conventional army loses if it doesn't win.
Right.
certainly today in the propaganda war within the PA, within the Palestinians, so Hamas was put center stage. Hamas was sitting with Morsi. Morsi became an international figure, president calling him, everybody building him up. Turkey gets brought in. Qatar gets brought in. None of these countries that are at all sympathetic with Israel and all represent a sort of extremist wing of the and are all Muslim Brotherhood oriented. Qatar is not Muslim Brotherhood, obviously. And I think Abbas stood and looked at this and said, I have no role. I'm marginalized. I don't even get a press conference here. And I think that...
not even that, in the photo op with the ceasefire.
Exactly.
So now, I guess... It's frustrating because you know what people like us think about Hamas, and they end up being the big player here, and the Egyptians, who are now led, you know, by representatives of the Muslim Brotherhood, and not by quote unquote more moderate leadership like supposedly they were years ago, are the brokers of this whole process. I mean, Israel, which always tries to avoid doing business with terrorists that are out to kill, looks like they had no choice but to deal with those types this time around.
Well, Israel did and achieved what it set out to achieve. Even though people were expecting a land invasion or other measures, Israel's first goal was to remove the Fajr 5 and Fajr 3 missiles.
Right.
They did it. More than 100 of these long-range missiles had been smuggled in. Israel eliminated almost all of them on the first day. A few that were left were fired subsequently. There are attempts now already at resupply.
I was just going to say, Malcolm, excuse me for interrupting, but how many are already back in?
Well, no, they're not getting back in so quickly, and I think Egypt will... tried to prevent it. This is a pledge they took. The Egyptians have not been very careful about the smuggling issue till now.
Well, I mean, we could take Morsi at his word that he's going to try to help stop this type of activity?
This is not being left to Morsi. Believe me, Israelis are monitoring this very carefully. The United States is monitoring it very carefully. You can do this with satellites. You can do this in other ways. In the same way that yesterday they picked up a huge truck load, maybe a convoy of 185 crates of weapons, a huge stockpile that was going through the Sinai to Gaza. The Egyptians captured it, announced it. There are, you remember the attack in Khartoum, which I said at the time, people should look at the distance. It's the same from Tel Aviv to Khartoum as it is Tel Aviv to Tehran.
Right.
Now, this, you saw in the last 48 hours, people are all of a sudden measuring the distance again.
Well, I'll tell you, Charles Krauthammer was on this show 2 days ago, and he and so many others continue to say that this showdown was just a warm-up, was just a practice session for the big one. I mean,
and it sent many messages. One, that Israel has the sophisticated avionics. Two, that they were able to shut off all of the TV and radio, and you know that the Israel took over the Hamas television radio without taking over a building, just as they shut off the electricity, or whoever hit in Khartoum shut off the electricity just prior to the attack. They showed that they could pinpoint hit, and 1,000 strikes, less than 100 people killed, and even by the Gazans' admission, 80% of them terrorists. So think about what this means, shooting at sites, launch sites, between buildings, next to a hospital, and virtually no civilian casualties and a very limited number of people wounded. So the message about Israel's capability, the second thing is that Iron Dome works.
Right.
And the fact that it works so successfully is a message that removes the threat, a large part of the missile threat that Iran has, because, you know, they would launch a limited number. It's not like Hezbollah, for instance, which has 50,000 and they could tried a massive launch, but they also looked at it, and they didn't move a single troop, they didn't mobilize, they didn't do anything during this conflict, so that there are multiple messages that people have to look at what happened. Number one, this was never intended to be an all-out war. It was meant to be a limited action to stop the rockets, to destroy the infrastructure of the Hamas. They can dance, but today they go back and they see that virtually every government building is flat. I mean, it looks like a multiple Sandy hit on the Gaza Strip. They depleted a large part of the missile base. Now, I'm telling you that the people in Israel, many of them were disappointed. 70% wanted them to go in. The people in the south we met you know, had wanted them.
Even in the South, the people that are subjected to those rockets constantly, they wanted Israel to go in and finish the job.
And so did many of the soldiers we met, and so did many others. But I think in hindsight, because the fear is that this is only one round, and they're going to restock, and they're going to come back and come back. Just think, on the other hand, what it would have meant, the casualties that Israel would have taken, the difficulty in Gaza. And when you have achieved a good part of your goal, and you establish certain parameters, we will see. If it's not quiet, Israel acquiesced. Israel, I think, gained international legitimacy. And even if you look at how many Arab countries did not say a single word
right.
in support of Hamas this time.
Right.
And, you know, you can have the automatics, as I said, to Qatar and Turkey, but by and large, they were silent. And Hamas, no one expects them to stop the smuggling. Egypt is the one now that's going to be put to the test, and Morsi has a lot of diversions right now, but they removed many of the tunnels. You know, I don't think people understand how effective the strikes that Israel engaged in. The Hamas claims they shot down 7 Israeli aircraft. You know, they do all these exaggerated claims. But bottom line, that Israel did what it had to do at this stage. I was hoping that they would be able to permanently eliminate the threat. We hope they did. But they couldn't eliminate Hamas, because, again, you're left. Leaving a vacuum would have meant that the Islamist groups, the Jihad, the Shura Council, would have taken over, which would not have improved the situation, might have made it worse, and would have entailed heavy casualties in the process.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Big thank you to everybody who made our Hurricane Sandy Emergency Fund a great success. We are almost at JMNAM at 100% of our goal, and WFMU has exceeded that already. I thank everybody who responded so generously, an amazing show of support for us after the damage at our two transmitter sites and in this building to our equipment, and we greatly appreciate that. I also want to remind everybody there is a weekly update podcast, information on the homepage at jmnam.org, where you can have the weekly update on a weekly basis delivered straight to your iTunes. Malcolm Honlein with us. He's Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, was in Israel last week, as you heard him mention earlier. And we'll get to the Israeli political scene in just a moment. In terms of the those who remained quiet, didn't say a word, etc., and I understand the support that Iran has for Hamas and their activities down south. Were there any public statements? Did the Presidium of Iran show or come out with statements of support for Hamas during the whole conflict, or even they remain completely quiet?
Oh, no. They came out very strongly, repeatedly condemning Israel, threatening Israel. They tried to use this to renew the ties. So while there is a split between Hamas and Iran, their patron, over Syria, which remains and is real, and that's why the others try to fill the void, meaning Turkey, Morsi, who are working together. The fact is that the weapons are still coming from Iran. Iran is still obviously giving them money and support, even if not to the degrees in the past. But they're trying right now to send weapons to the Sudan again to resupply, because they want to get the reputation. They want to be able to show that they are relevant. So Iran's role was more limited. They were eclipsed in this, but certainly were heard from very often.
All right. And
we must say one other thing.
Yeah.
There was a terrible thing in Iran yesterday where a 57-year-old Jewish woman was brutally stabbed and killed because the neighbors and the people where she lived in Isfahan wanted to take her house to add to the mosque, and she didn't want to sell. She wanted to stay in her house, and they just brutally killed her yesterday. This is the first such incident we've had in a long time, in years.
And that was in Tehran?
Isfahan. So we are very concerned about it, and always about whether the mood changes. And we should also note that Iran has taken advantage of the attention being focused on at the UN and Gaza and other places to expand by 700 the number of centrifuges, doubling the speed, increasing by a third the amount of enriched uranium. We see the reports that have come out that they found the diagrams, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that showed that the explosives, the kind of things that they want, bombs that they want to build. So all of those who had any question about the extent of their effort,
right.
And it also narrows the window by everybody's estimation.
Right. Well, we know that that's quickly approaching. The Netanyahu deadline, is the summer of 2013.
Well, no, I think it's the spring of
2013. Right. Excuse me.
But now they're talking about a 3-4 month period. The United States said again that they give him till March to negotiate. I think that's much too big a window.
Yeah, of course.
You'll see the Senate come up with new sanctions. They're going to try and raise the temperature on this.
Right, Malcolm. I even hate bringing this up because of the. Sometimes it's ridiculous to try to predict these things, and probably every Q&A you've done over the last half a year has included, is Israel going to bomb Iran? But you talk about this being a model for what possibly could happen in the future, meaning the operation on the border of the Gaza Strip. Is there a point where people in Israel tell you, and again, I don't know if this is invading, confidentiality, but where people in Israel, and they'll tell you that there's no need to worry about the fact that there's so many different facilities in different places. There are only a couple of key facilities that have to be hit. Or if a message is sent at one or two of those areas by the Israeli Air Force, by the Israeli military, that will be good enough. Did we learn from this lesson that just the show of strength and the show of power may be enough to deter the enemy from taking drastic action?
My question is, since when are you ever hesitant to invade by this information? The answer, I think the answer is that if Israel decides to go ahead, I think they have the capability and the plans, and will need, it would be much more preferable if the international community does it, led by the United States, the Europeans, with others. I think the Arab world is waiting for Israel to do it. Most of the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, fear Iran much more even than Israel because they don't feel they have any defense. And Iran, as I said, is becoming more aggressive. They opened a base at Abu Musa. They challenged the Saudi shipping. But the removal of one or two sites, if it's the key sites like Al-Fordo, which is underground, requires huge operation, or the Natanz or others, but if you don't really set back the program more than a few months, this can't be a symbolic act, meaning that you cut off just the top of the tower, but you leave the rest of it there, which they can rebuild in a few months. That will not be successful, as seen as a success. It will, in fact, perhaps be counterproductive. Therefore, whatever is done has to really cripple the nuclear program.
Wow. It's going to be a big challenge, that's for sure.
And very complicated, and I know people, say, compare it to Iraq.
Right.
Not at
and
all.
Syria. And Syria.
And taking out the Syrian thing, it shows that they have capabilities. But, you're talking about a significant distance. You're talking about a country with a lot of power.
I know, but this war, and again, armchair quarterback, sitting like everybody, or military armchair quarterback like everybody else in this area of the world. We're not, I'm sure you met plenty of people whose sons and daughters were sitting on the front lines in Gaza. This whole operation just seemed to give supporters of Israel such a boost of confidence about what Israel's able to do.
It should. It was a tremendous, technologically, an amazing effort by the Israeli Air Force. It showed its capabilities. Hamas is not without resources, and the pinpoint nature, the electronics that they were able to employ, I think these are all impressive. I know people focus only on the alchemy,
right,
things that they wanted to see. They wanted to see carpet bombing. The reason why Israel maintained the international support that it did throughout the operation, I think, was because of the way it was conducted and because they had set limited objectives. They couldn't say in the beginning, this is, only going to do so, X, Y, and Z, we're not going to go any further, because then you've told Hamas to just what your objectives are, and the presence of the troops and else would have been meaningless. I think Israel would have gone in had they decided that that would have produced a different result than what they were able to achieve, and put their soldiers really in very right. dangerous situations.
And I got to be careful because there are plenty of people outside of Israel who have sons and daughters who are serving in the IDF.
And we had them at dinner, Chayalim Bodedim, you know, the lone soldiers who came from Sugar Land, Texas, and from other places. They are the most amazing young men. Amazing. I mean, American educated, articulate, so devoted, two of them at Kibbutz Sa'ad, just so remarkable that people think these are, you know, people who didn't find their way. These are devoted, dedicated, with clear objectives and goals. I'm saying to you that these, the yep. parents of these kids should be extremely proud.
Oh, yeah, a lot of our listening audience who have children in the Israeli army. All right, we got to talk about the political scene. Obviously, we'll have time over subsequent weeks as we get closer and closer to this election, but so much has happened over the last few days. We'll start in order of how it happened. Tell me about the Barak resignation from the Israeli political scene.
You know, somebody described it that it's Israeli political scene is a revolving door. and you know, they go out 1 week, they're back the next, they come in under a different guise. You know, they get recycled all the time. And, I mean, it's an environmentally sound program because nobody goes to waste. But
no wonder Bibi's doing so well. While he sits at the top, he watches everybody recycle.
But the numbers were clear. His party would have done very poorly. You know, he has been involved in business that gets made a lot of money in the interim years, and maybe he wants to go back to that.
So don't be shocked if he ends up in the political arena again.
I would not be, and you wouldn't be shocked today if Olmert would get
right.
back in some way, and yet if I'd asked you 3 months ago, you would have been shocked. So
right.
things change in Israel very rapidly.
Tell me about Tzipi Livni and Hatnua.
Well, it comes in, I think she did it because she felt that Olmert was not going to come in, even though he keeps holding it out to keep in the press. And he very regrettably yesterday endorsed the Palestinian move in the UN. I think it was...
Olmert did!
Yes, I think it was very, to be, what was the words they used? Unfortunate and counterproductive,
wow.
as was the move in the UN by the PA. I think his move was also. And it sends mixed signals. It's not appropriate. I think that the polls show that the majority of Israelis did not want him to come back. You know, he's very smart. He's a leader, and he probably could, you know, garner support enough to get into the Knesset and benefit some party. But what is interesting with Tzipi Livni and with the others is that they're all dividing up the center-left.
Right.
Center-right remains. They're not going over to a Tzipi Livni. You get some of the, on the side, you get some of the middle, the old Kadima voters. I mean, Kadima hardly doesn't make the threshold right now. Labor is a little bit resurgent, and they've gotten a lot of good young people. Tzipi Livni lined up some business executives, so each of them can come in. If they coalesce into a single unit, they will have there will be the, you know, a unified opposition. If they stay divided, it will be much weaker because you have Yair Lapid now.
Right.
You have competition. I don't think anybody could tell you what the final outcome. What we've seen on the right, though, is within the Likud primaries, the hard right did very well. You have Naftali Bennett in what I guess is a resurrected Mafnal doing very well in the polls, and Aryeh Deri with Shas doing well.
Is Bennett the superstar in Israel that everyone here 6,000 miles away says he is?
Well, he certainly has made a big impression. He's very articulate, smart.
Is he the reason that everything moved to the right? Because we saw in the last Likud primary it wasn't like this.
You know, I think they would have moved to the right in any event, but it certainly perhaps was a factor for them. And, you know, the constituency of the right is shifting more right. The constituency on the left, I think, has moved more right. That the left is not the left of the past. You
right.
don't see Meretz surging. You don't see the extreme left surging. So it's you may see eventually a coalescence of parties, and you end up with a right-left split. But right now, I think the situation is very confused, and until after the primaries are all over and people settle down and you start getting closer to the election, I think right now no one sees an alternative to Netanyahu, that no one will see anybody else who will be the next prime minister.
What's his?
Who's in the coalition?
What's his strategy now? I mean,
survive.
Do we have any clue? Any clue? It's only November 30th, but do we have an indication of how many total seats he may directly control at this point, according to the polls?
Yes, they vary, and it varies from, I would say, most people would say between 30 and 35, that he is likely to emerge with between him and Yisrael Beiteinu, now that he's merged with Lieberman. Again, events will dictate a lot of this, economic conditions, which are a very serious matter. The security situation, if Hamas somehow starts firing again, that will be a huge blow. I don't anticipate it. I think that they will be silent till certainly through the elections in January.
Mm-hmm.
So people will assess it. The social issues come to the fore as well, domestic issues, as they did here. And, of course, Iran looms over it as well, and people will say, who do they have confidence in to lead it? I think there will be a lot of discussions about who the next defense minister will be. Bogi Yaalon's name is being mentioned. Other people, he did very well also in the primaries.
Someone told me Barak could stay because of the meaning he could be asked by Netanyahu again because he doesn't have to be
right.
A member of Knesset?
Yes, that is true, that you could have
a cabinet member?
People say Dan Meridor. Others will be brought back in some form. Meridor's name is now being put forward to challenge the mayor of Jerusalem in the next election.
Ooh.
A lot of interesting ramifications. You know, it starts immediately.
When is that? Is that,
hiatus,
is mayor a 2013 election?
I think it's 2013. No, yeah, probably 13 or 14. But
wow.
I'm pretty sure it's 13.
That's interesting. He continues to be popular, Barakat, or not?
It's mixed, you know, but people haven't really focused on that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Hasn't been that high profile.
It's hard to say what, you know, he's done a lot of good. He's trying to build up Jerusalem. But, you know, when you live there and you face the issues, it's a tough situation, especially when you have so many absentee people and residents.
Right.
Big issue.
Oh, yes. All right. I got to go back for a second. I want to thank. I want to thank my friend Dr. Nathan Lander, who continuously has been reminding me about this topic. And now, with what happened at the UN yesterday, I think it's appropriate to ask you about it. Have we gotten to this point where the United Nations vote went the way it did yesterday, and that the PA was able to become a non-member, non-member status at the UN because of the use of the term Palestinian and Palestine, and that big change that took place when those who were living near Israel were known as Arabs, and between their efforts and the media's efforts, the Palestinian cause became very popular over the last couple of decades. Do you think it was the beginning of that shift that ended up where we were yesterday in the UN?
Well, the Palestinians early didn't want to be called Palestinians. They wanted to be called the Arabs, and there are historic examples where they rejected the title, and in fact, you know, there never was a state called Palestine. And I know Dr. Lander discovered some documents and historic precedents for what is going on that are very interesting and certainly relevant to the debate now.
All right, so I guess that would be something of real analysis and probably a thesis or two, right?
At least.
In order to determine if, in fact, that type of activity or that type of propaganda or
effort. Maybe after they finish with Arafat's underwear and the three teams.
What's the conclusion on that?
Investigating. Well, there's the Swiss, Russian, and French teams that have they exhumed the body, and they spent many hours working on it to test to see if there's radiation of any kind, evidence of it. So we will know, I guess. It'll take some time, I think, before they disclose the results, if they disclose it, because if it isn't what the PA wants the results to be, they will not release it.
And is he back where he belongs, or is he still being examined?
Oh, he's where he belongs.
I'll tell you. What a trace.
You know, just because they exhumed the body.
We should know that, right?
Right.
Finally, the whole UN push and everything that happened yesterday, what is the next step for the PA. Is Abbas going to be visiting the United States? Is Netanyahu's, is he going to try to get back to the negotiating table using President Obama now that he is about to be sworn in for his second term? Netanyahu likely is going to win his next term. Is there going to be another peace talk a session going on in Washington? What do you think the next step is?
Those are all possibilities, and it's a good question. I don't foresee a visit by Abbas right now to Washington. He was invited. Arakat was asked to come to Washington this week, you know, because they were trying to modify the language and get them to acquiesce. And he turned no. He said, "I'll come after the vote. I'm not coming now." So they really acted with I think a lot of chutzpah against the United States, against the interests of the positions the United States was advocating. So I don't foresee a visit anytime soon. I do see efforts to resume the negotiations. It is a position Netanyahu continues to advocate without precondition. I think yesterday's events set it back. I think any action to go to the international court will be a death blow, or even if they go to specialized agency, which will require cutoff of funding. I think I hope that there will be measures taken by the U.S. and by Israel that sends some message of the consequence of the actions that were taken. So I think for right now, you know, they will try to bask in the glory of their non-victory, that they will try to exploit it, you know, for political and other purposes. But let's see, this guy hasn't faced an election, Abbas, in years.
Right.
Long overdue, many years overdue. He's not a legitimate regime. He's certainly not in control of Gaza, and he has a lot of opposition internally. Maybe he'll take advantage of the moment to exploit it and call a snap election. I'm not so sure that he's prepared to stand the test of what it would mean.
And finally, Malcolm, you were there last week. You were our eyes and ears in the Holy Land as all this was going on, and you led the Solidarity Mission and certainly released many statements regarding what you saw. But what was the story? What was the sight? What was the, I don't know, maybe you saw some of the damage. What was the moment of the trip that you could report back to us was the one that caught you the most?
In the hospital in Be'er Sheva, meeting with a family whose home had been hit by a rocket in Kiryat Malachi that went right into through the apartment, actually. And the father lost his leg. It had been amputated. And I was at his bedside holding his hand, or he was holding my hand much tighter. And as I, you know, made some comments to him, he looked at me and he said, "Don't worry, we are strong. We are strong. I will be back at work. We are building. We're not worried." He said, "But you have such courage that you came here and that you..." And I said to him, "Please don't do that. We're not just courage on our part. Look, guys, what you stood every day, by your presence, by your resilience, by your courage." And everywhere we went, people kept thanking us and saying, "Oh, it's great that you came, great you came." And I will tell you that it recharged our battery. If you see the resilience of the people in the South, and the most significant thing was when they kept asking me, "How are the Jews in New York dealing with Sandy?"
Unbelievable.
I'm not kidding you. Over and over again, do they need help? What's how are they doing? These are people who, for a year, have had 1,000 rockets before the war and 1,000 since the war. For all these years, they haven't had economic life as a normal thing. Their children never slept outside a bunker. And what do they ask? "How are the Jews dealing with Sandy in New York?"
Unbelievable.
It's really Mikam Chal Yisrael. People, they can't imagine. And while we're talking about Achdus and the unity of the Jewish people, we should remember two things. People, one is Gross, and of course Pollard, whose condition is going to, in 100 days I think or so, it's going to be the 10,000th day in prison. But Alan Gross, whom the Cubans are manipulating the situation, and they called a press conference this week, which we had hoped, because it's the third anniversary tomorrow of his incarceration.
Well, what's his health situation?
So he was visited by someone from New York, a rabbi doctor, who examined him and said that, you know, he didn't see signs of cancer, but he's not an oncologist, so there needs further examination. He's lost 100 pounds. He's certainly not well, but his mother has cancer. His sister-in-law just had a serious medical problem. They're alone without him. And on a spurious charge, if the Cubans wanted to send a message, they sent it. It's really time that he be released. And we prayed that Jacob Oestreicher, you saw that, may have seen some of the articles in the press in Bolivia where they've arrested the judge, all the prosecutors, everybody connected to the case for fraud. And they say that they stole money from this Jew from New York, and they literally vindicate everything that Jacob and his wife, who has been amazing in this, and others who have advocated for him, and people went, now Sean Penn went there. I think that I'm hopeful maybe there will be a change, but we should remember these people, and feel this is maybe an opportunity that we redeem these captives of the Jewish people.
Amen. Thank you, Malcolm. Great report. We'll speak again next week. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.
Malcolm Homeline is Executive Vice Chairman, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.